Good morning, everyone. Please excuse my voice. I'm a bit congested, but we'll see how we go. This morning I'll be reading from Ecclesiastes 1:1-11. Everything is meaningless. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and then the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and then turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was all here already long ago. It was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them.
Amen. Unless you're dismissed. Yeah, it's all very upbeat, very exciting way to sort of start things, but this is Ecclesiastes as we start that today. I don't know if you've travelled, if you've been around the world, if you've been to different sites. There are some amazing places around the world where there is all kinds of ruins from different civilizations that have gone by. And you can go to these places, you can stand there. And in some cases, we know a bit about what went forward. There's some history or some, you know, bits. You go to Greece and there's all the different ruins around Greece, or go to other parts of the world and there's the ruins of Rome and the ruins of other places that we have. Some parts of the world you can go to and all we have are the ruins. The language has been lost, and so even the inscriptions, we don't actually know what they're saying. Something significant took place at some time. But did it really matter? Did the things that these people achieve actually have any great significance? Well, in some cases, you can point to what it led to. Obviously, Greece is the background to much of Western civilization. Some of them, you have to wonder if the stories of the individuals that were there actually have any meaning or significance whatsoever. Maybe some who built some of these amazing things, they've still gone on to die just like everybody else does. Does it actually matter? As we start today in particular, I want to pose the question. What if atheists are right? What if there is no God? It's a question worth pondering. It's a question worth considering, even though many here might be of the persuasion that God is real. I don't know, maybe you are here today and you're exploring faith, you're exploring reason. Maybe you're not convinced there is a God, but you're wanting to actually explore and just see, what if I am wrong? Well, then it's worth also for those of us who follow Jesus, who believe in God, to consider the alternative. What if atheists are right and there is no God? Well, actually, what I'd want to suggest, and I think this is partly where we're going to go through Ecclesiastes today and across the next few weeks, is that whether you believe in God or not, whether you do think God is real or you think God is not real, you should actually want God to exist. Whether you think he does or whether you think God is completely just not true whatsoever, you should want God to exist. We're starting a series, 4 weeks, looking at Ecclesiastes, the meaning of life is. And it's really quite a famous one, as we'll sort of get to as it was read out to us before. Just a little bit of background about Ecclesiastes, in case you haven't read it, in case it's one that you've just gone, that's the too hard basket, doesn't make sense, don't understand, let's move on to the next thing. Ecclesiastes is a book that explores the natural outcomes of two worldviews. It explores what does the world mean if there is a God, a theistic worldview, and remember that doesn't mean the Christian God, it's just that there is a God or gods. So it examines what happens in a world where there is a God and what happens in a world where there isn't a God, an atheistic worldview. And they're the two views that Ecclesiastes wants to consider and compare and contrast and think about the impact that that has on the world around us. The genre, and this is why it puts some people off, is the genre is wisdom literature. Now, this doesn't mean that it's just about wisdom, but it's wanting to present and understand what are some wise teachings, what are some wise sayings. And it's long-form Hebrew poetry, which is what makes it complicated, because we don't read long-form Hebrew poetry every day. Well, I don't. Maybe I won't speak for you. Maybe that's your chosen genre. But in general, most of us don't make a habit of reading long-form Hebrew poetry every day. And one of the most challenging things behind Hebrew long-form poetry, why it is complicated to read and understand, is it doesn't follow a logical progression. Long-form Hebrew poetry is not interested in going A plus B equals C. It is not interested in putting a point there and a point there and a point there and building a case to come to a conclusion. Long-form Hebrew poetry, like a lot of poetry, actually has a rhythm and a cadence that can jump all over the place. Now, again, not all poetry is that way. Much poetry actually has a very sort of musical tone of ups and downs. Then you read that poetry, you're like, what was that poet on? Like, what were they thinking about? What were they saying? What were they doing? It makes no sense. And so one of the challenges to reading Ecclesiastes, it is poetry, it's Hebrew poetry, and it's not a logical flow. So what we're going to try and do over the next 4 weeks is pull a bit of logic out of it so that we can grapple and we can actually think about what it's trying to say, follow and pull some threads in different places and just see where those things go. So jump with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. We're going to start right at the very beginning. In verse 1. And the verse 1 of Ecclesiastes chapter 1 says this: the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. The word for teacher here is the word koheleth. That's what's been translated as teacher. It's historically been seen as Solomon. But there's not actually a lot of evidence that it definitely was Solomon. Or one of the theories is that actually this is kind of a collection of teachings by various sons of David. So it's very clear it says the son of David, so it's got to be from the line of David. But there were obviously many kings that followed David. Now, we know Solomon wrote a lot of wisdom literature. He wrote much of Proverbs. He wrote lots of things around that. And so we know that this is definitely the sort of writing Solomon would do. But generally speaking, Solomon was pretty good at actually saying, Solomon wrote this. Or there's a lot of other things around it being, this was definitely Solomon. But for this author to say the teacher, rather than specifying it as being Solomon, gives some doubt as to whether or not it was actually Solomon. Does that matter too much? Not entirely, except that you just can't just openly say, this was definitely Solomon, and then line it up with all of Solomon's other writings. It was definitely someone who was taking on some kind of Solomon persona and was happy for you to assume that it was Solomon, whether or not it actually was. But you also need to be aware, and this is missed a lot, is that the teacher, is not the author of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is majority the writings of this teacher. But at the very start, our first verse is actually an author who gives a bit of a background to it. And then at the very end of Ecclesiastes, which we'll come to in week 4, there's a little summary statement that was also clearly not written by the person who is mostly speaking throughout Ecclesiastes. And so what has happened is someone has collected all these teachings of the teacher. And they've put them in the order they've put them in. Remember, not logical, but in the order that it's found in, to bring across a particular point. And so there's an author involved, and there's a teacher involved, and they're not the same person. So we come to our famous beginning. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, or vanity of vanities, if you're reading some of the older translations. Everything, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What a great way. I mean, this is one of the, when you go into a movie and the movie captures your attention from the start. You can't really read, you might not like what this says, or you might go, oh, wow, that's too hard for me, I'm going to put that down. But you can't say this doesn't grab you. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. The word for meaningless here is hevel or hebel, depending on how you sort of want to use it, the translation over into the English. It has a few different ways of being translated. Generally speaking, if you want a like-for-like word, it's either steam, vapor, breath, nonsense, or absurd. So you can see there's a wide breadth of potential interpretations of what this word could actually be. In this case, obviously, it's translated as meaningless. In other translations, it's vanities. It's wanting to bring across that idea of being something that's hard to grasp or something that seems a bit ridiculous or nonsense. Generally speaking, when it's used metaphorically, you'll actually find that it's translated as absurd. And so when you're reading this meaningless, sort of put it in that perspective of absurd, absurd, says the teacher, utterly absurd. Everything is absurd. Doesn't make sense. Isn't logical. What's going on in the world? But then in other instances, vapor actually is a really good definition. And in fact, it's used later on in Ecclesiastes. It is translated as vapor because it's that idea of it's having an impact on things, but I can't grab it. It's there, it's real, but it's not something that I can tangibly grab. And so it's bringing across this idea of life being almost hard to fathom and comprehend and understand. There's something difficult about appreciating and understanding what's going on. So then it goes in to say, what do people gain from all the labors at which they toil under the sun? Under the sun is used 29 times. It's a phrase that's repeated and used in multiple different ways. And it's used nowhere else in the entire Hebrew scriptures. So it's something that for whatever reason was really important to the writer in this time, to the teacher. But it actually is not used, is not a concept that's actually explored anywhere else in the Hebrew Bible. But it refers to a mortal or earthly perspective. So when you read about under the sun, what it's trying to present is, if you remove anything spiritual or anything beyond the physical nature in this world, that's what it's exploring. So under the sun, what do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? In this lifetime, in this perspective, in a world where only the world exists. Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the north, to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. Amen? Yeah? No? Okay, maybe not. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. This is obviously being a bit, it's generalizing. We remember some of the people that have gone before us. We have histories of different nations in different times. But we also have definitely got cases where there are lost nations, lost histories. People whose achievements have been lost in the fullness of time. Many, if not most, people who exist have no evidence of their existence after a couple of hundred years. Once the cemeteries disappear, once the books and the times, if you weren't a king or a special, it's a little bit different our time. We've got a whole lot more, though, now that everything's moving digitally. In a few hundred thousand years' time, will we actually have any history of our existence in this time? And so the teacher is wanting to explore what is going on in a world where only the world exists, where there's nothing beyond this life, nothing beyond what is going on. It's actually a very pessimistic worldview, and it's being very deliberately done by this teacher, wanting to express time just goes by. It doesn't care about what you're caring about at the moment. Give it 100 years and your cares today will be completely gone because you'll be gone. Other people might have some worries and concerns, but give them 100 years and then time doesn't care. It just moves on. Meaningless, meaningless. Utterly meaningless. So the teacher is looking at this idea and saying, if you consider life just under the sun, time makes everything meaningless. As time goes by, things move past. We're forgotten. What's gone before, in many, if not most ways, is forgotten. It's a pessimistic perspective. But then if you move forward in the book and you move to chapter 3, and look at verses 1-8. There's a very different idea. Same book, same teacher. Different perspective. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. And so the author expresses time in a different perspective. That there's a time for this and a time for that. That they're both important, that they both have meaning, that they both have significance. And so the idea that's presented here, and again, it's not logical. God is not on the scene yet. Up until this point in the book of Ecclesiastes, the character of God has not made an appearance. So though these things don't require a God, they do actually make more sense in light of one. That there would be a being that creates rhythm and seasons and structure and order. That when you take these things and you add the time to them, it allows them to make more sense. That there is a time to celebrate. You got some great news. Celebrate, have cake, get your family together, go yes. And then there's a time to grieve. You got some bad news. You got a diagnosis. You lost a friend. You lost a colleague. That these things in their time have significance and have meaning. And in particular, these things have meaning in the light of a life that takes in more than just what happens under the sun. Ecclesiastes 3, 9-11 says this. What do workers gain from their toil? I have seen the burden God, there we go, we have God, has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to the end. And so right here in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, a new character enters the mix, and it's the character of God. It's the first time that God comes on the scene. But the teacher wants to present this idea that it's God that makes everything beautiful in its time. That it's God that has a set eternity in our hearts. And it's God who is not fully understandable. Up until this point, all of Ecclesiastes has been, consider how time makes everything meaningless. So what is it that brings meaning to time? Well, it's the one who is outside of time, who grants a time for this and a time for that. Time to love and a time to hate. A time to heal, a time to mend, a time to do all of these things. That when you consider God in a pessimistic place, what is pessimistic can become optimistic. That it's the character of God that actually brings meaning to our existence. If you remove God from the scene, we live, we die, we're gone. If you remove the spiritual realm from the scene, you live, you die, we're gone. You might achieve some amazing things. You might get a fortune. When you're put into the ground, your kids might appreciate that. But as far as you are concerned, that is gone. It means nothing. Has no bearing, makes your life no better because your life is no more. Ecclesiastes 3, 12 to 14 says this. I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live. That each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him. So the teacher is actually very encouraging of the idea that you should actually be happy, you should do good. Find satisfaction in what you do, in your life, in your job, in your family, in wherever you might find yourself. It is not a problem to seek or desire happiness. Come back next week, we're going to delve into that a little bit more. That's a very significant topic in the book of Ecclesiastes. But this is the gift of God, to be happy, to do good, to find satisfaction. And that when you have a bigger perspective and a worldview understanding that God is there, that God is with us, it makes this a whole lot more achievable and a whole lot more manageable. Doesn't mean it's easy. Doesn't mean that there aren't going to be seasons of life where you have some downtimes. We covered that. That was before. There's a time to be happy. There's a time to be sad. There's a time for things to go well. There's a time for things not to go so well. But what God does will endure forever. So in a world where there is a God that exists, we can tie ourselves to that world. We can tie ourselves to that God. We can actually gain significance and meaning through the way that we live and explore with that God. And if God does not exist, if there is no God, if the atheistic worldview is right, then whether you live a good life or whether you live a horrendous life ultimately has no bearing. Will make no difference when you're 6 feet under. That's the perspective of the teacher. Whatever is has already been. What will be has been before. And God will call the past to account. So very similar verse at the beginning to what was actually a bit earlier. What has been, whatever is has already been. It's happened, it's gone, it's in the past. And what will be has been before. We tend to see lots of cycles. Things go in swings and roundabouts and we think we get through something and then the mullets come back. And we move on. And hopefully we get through that and they disappear again. But again, we've got a key character in this sentence. We have God. See, if God is not on the scene, whatever has been, has been. Whatever will be, will be. But it's only with God that we have any hope that justice will actually prevail. If there is no God, there is no reason to believe in justice. If there is no God, there is no reason to believe that things that have occurred that should not have occurred will ever actually have any outcome or anything that actually comes of them. But if there is a God who is outside of time, if there is a God who created this world and gives it its purpose and gives it its time and its seasons and its rhythms, and that ultimately this God will one day call all that has happened to account. And so if we're people who believe or desire or want to see justice, and we look at the world today and we look at just the significant amount of injustice that takes place, and we in the West are shielded from so much of the injustice, if we desire and hope for and long to see injustice called to account, the only worldview that actually allows for that to occur is a worldview in which God exists. That is what Ecclesiastes is wanting to express. That whether or not you actually think this is God, you should want there to be. Because it's God that will make sure that in the end, justice prevails. The world is a better place. Again, obviously, atheists have some answers or responses to what I'm saying today. It's not just as black and white and as simple as this. Obviously, atheists have had to consider this. Those who would hold to an atheistic worldview have to look into the realities of the weakness of an atheistic perspective. But the teacher of Ecclesiastes would be as clear and as blunt as this. The world is a better place if God exists. See, Ecclesiastes doesn't actually try and prove that God exists. Ecclesiastes is not interested in the arguments for or against God actually existing, but it absolutely makes the case that it is better if God exists. That ultimately everything is better off if there is a God in this world. And even in this teaching, it doesn't go into specifically saying Yahweh. When it's talking about God, it's not necessarily talking about the God of the Hebrews. Though that is obviously connected. It's the perspective of actually just having a theistic view of the world. I don't know about you, maybe you're one of those who would say, I can't believe there is a God. Because of all the injustice that's in the world. I mean, how could a good God allow this injustice to reign? How could a good God allow this to happen? Have you seen what happened to my friends? Have you seen what's happening in this country and the world? Have you seen what's taking place? We will speak to that again in a couple of weeks' time. It comes up throughout Ecclesiastes. But ultimately, you should want God to exist, because without God, there is no guarantee for any level of justice. If there is not some being that is beyond this world who in some way is interacting with this world, there is actually no need for justice to occur. There is no guarantee that anyone would ever see any level of justice. And I will steal my thunder from a couple of weeks' time, for those who aren't here then, so you can just have this in advance. Ecclesiastes is clear, is there is not a world that exists with a God who doesn't allow injustice. That for whatever reason, absolutely, if there is a God that exists allows injustice to be here. That if there is a God, that God allows bad things to happen. There is no such thing as a God who stops bad things from happening at all. And that's something we can wrestle with, and the teacher has some thoughts about that, and there's some different things we can go down. But it is something that those of a theistic worldview have to wrestle with. That's the counter. An atheistic worldview has to counter the idea of how do you have meaning in a world without God? The theistic worldview has to counter how do we explain the fact that there is so much atrocity, and obviously there are Christian theories around sin and different things around that. It doesn't make it any more comfortable. It doesn't make it any easier. Because if I had the power to stop something bad from happening, I like to think I will. Okay, there are times maybe I don't. So maybe I would say that's because I'm not perfect, but God is. So how does God do it? How does God allow those things to happen? That is a reality that if God does exist, God allows those things to happen. But ultimately, justice is only really guaranteed if we live in a world where God exists. So if you don't believe in God, maybe you're here today and you don't actually believe in God, you're exploring Christianity or exploring the idea, all I want you to do from today is to go away and ask yourself this question. What if God is true? So you're not sure that God is, not sure that they are, not sure there's not lots of gods or that maybe there's no gods whatsoever. Just ponder the question. What if God is true? How would that change your life? How would that change your understanding of the world? What is the alternative if God doesn't exist? And how does that shape the world that you live in? And if you're here today and maybe you're on the other side of the fence, you've decided to follow Jesus. You've decided that there is a God, whether that's the Christian God or maybe it's another God. That's not actually where this question ends, because here's where the next part of the question is. Does the way you are living your life suggest that you really believe in God? If someone was to come and to vet your life and to vet the way you're living and vet the decisions that you're making and vet the way that you're finding meaning and purpose and how you choose to make decisions and what you choose to do and where you're choosing to work and who you're choosing to associate with, do those things scream loud and clear that you believe that God exists? Are you allowing the reality of God's existence to permeate into every part of your life and to shape every part of your life and to bring hope and joy and God's presence into every part of your life? Do the people around you see a hope? Do people see you in the way that you're living and saying, I want the Christian God to be true. I so want that to be true because I can see how this person that follows Jesus experiences the life that comes from following Jesus. Or maybe they see you in the bad times. They see you in the dark times. They see how you handle grief. They see how you handle loss. They see how you handle pain. They see how you handle not having things go the way you'd like them to. And somehow you have a strength that they would want to have. Because they're just not sure that they could do it that way. Because you have a hope that there is a God who brings justice. Because you believe that there is more to this life than just what is under the sun. Because you believe that ultimately God will bring into reality all of the goodnesses and the purposes that were there when he created this world. Does your life shout that from the rafters? Because that's what it means to believe that God is real. Meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless unless God. Father, we pray that you'd help us over this next month as we wrestle with Ecclesiastes, wrestle with its meaning and its purpose and its wisdom. I pray that you would help us to explore its teachings. I thank you that you are real and you are there, and you make this life a life that has meaning and purpose. Help each of us this day and every day to live in the reality of our belief in you. And we thank you and we look forward to and we long for the day where justice reigns. We thank you in Jesus' name.